Welcome to the podcast series, Intel on AI. Each episode explores human-centric topics related to artificial intelligence through conversations with leaders in the field. I'm your host, Abigail Hing Nguyen. Hello, I'm thrilled to be speaking today with Rana El-Kayoubi, co-founder and CEO of Affectiva, an emotion AI Boston-based company, as well as the author of Girl Decoded, her memoir, which just came out from Penguin Random House this April. Rana, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
I read Girl Decoded, and I really enjoyed how you discovered and found the courage to find your calling, to humanize our technology and how we connect with one another. And I'm really excited to talk with you today about your journey here, your work in emotion and AI, and save some time at the end for us to chat about the writing process and how publishing a book can also help to build a community. Does that sound good?
Sounds great.
So emotion and artificial intelligence is a really important critical area that has not had a lot of attention paid to yet. It's an area I'm very interested in myself as well. I actually began writing a novel about it in 2013, told through the view of a boy on the autism spectrum and an AI cyber world. I found as I was reading your memoir many similar points in your own work, and I'd love to start off with how you began your journey to becoming one of the leading experts in emotion and AI.
Yeah, so I grew up in the Middle East and my family were really immersed in technology. Both of my parents are in the tech industry. And so we were always exposed to the latest and greatest, you know, video gaming consoles and video recording devices. And for me, what always struck me is how technology brought us together as a family and how technology kind of is so deeply ingrained in human connection and how we connect and communicate with one another. So that's been a common theme in my work and research over the last 20 plus years. I studied computer science as an undergraduate, but again, was super fascinated by this intersection between humans and machines and that touch point, that interface. At the time, I really wanted to become an academic and so decided to focus my PhD work and research on building the first ever emotionally intelligent machine. That started this whole kind of obsession, if you like, with building technology that understands human emotions just like we do.
I'm fascinated by this intersection as well. Can you tell us about that very first machine that you built?
Yeah. So when I got to Cambridge University, you know, moved basically from Cairo, Egypt to Cambridge in the UK, I had this aha moment. I realized I was spending more time interacting with my computer than I did interacting with any other human being. Yet this machine, despite this intimacy, had absolutely no idea how I was feeling. And so I started imagining if just using kind of camera sensors at the time, obviously the world was different. So the webcams were big and blurry, but I started kind of imagining like, what if I could leverage computer vision to build technology that could read my emotions via my facial expressions. You can't see me, Abigail, right now, but I'm a very expressive human. So I wanted my computer to be able to capture my smile and my smirk and, you know, when I'm sad and upset. But I also had this realization that most of my communication with my family back home was via technology. And, you know, only 10% of how we communicate is via text. 90% is nonverbal between your facial expressions, your body language, your vocal intonation. And all of that disappears in cyberspace when we're just kind of, you know, communicating via text. So I wanted to change that. I wanted to build something that brings this emotional intelligence to our machines.
So where are you now in that process? Can you tell us more about your company?
After my PhD, I joined MIT as a postdoc with Professor Rosalind Picard. She wrote the book Affective Computing. So she was one of the very early pioneers in this space. At the time, what brought me over to the United States at MIT was a project to build a device that helps autistic kids to read and understand nonverbal cues. So we built a Google Glass-like device. This was way before Google Glass existed. And it had a little camera in it, and it would read and understand the expressions of people you were connecting with. And it gave you real-time feedback. So we deployed this device in a school for autistic kids. The kids loved it. We were already seeing that they were doing a lot more face contact and eye gaze connection with other people. But being at MIT, we also had very strong ties to industry. And twice a year, we would host all of these, you know, Fortune 500 companies. It was called Sponsor Week, but we also internally called it Demo or Die, because we had to show up with a demo of what we were building. And all these, you know, Fortune 500 companies wanted to buy the technology and apply it to their industry. And that was when we had this realization that there is a huge commercial opportunity here and we ought to spin out. In 2009, we started Affectiva. We're on a mission to humanize technology by bringing emotional intelligence to like a number of industries, everything from how we measure audience response, advertising, autism, automotive. The list goes on and on.
It's going to be an incredibly valuable tool on so many dimensions, commercial as well as for humanitarian efforts. How would you define emotional intelligence? How does it differ from IQ?
Emotional intelligence is about a person's ability to sense other people's emotional and cognitive states and behaviors and be able to adapt in real time based on that information. And we all do that all the time. In fact, people who have higher EQs tend to be more likable, they're more persuasive, they're better leaders, they're more successful in their professional and personal lives. So it's not just about our IQ, our EQ really matters. And we all know that from our personal experiences. You know, I just believe that this is equally true for technology, especially technology that is so deeply ingrained in our daily lives. It's not enough to build tech that has a lot of IQ. We need to pair that with a lot of EQ as well. We need to marry the two.
Well, the striking thing about the list that you just gave is that these are the qualities we often ascribe to humans and not to artificial intelligence. And yet here you are challenging even this division. Can you give us an example of how a system that's endowed with emotional intelligence is different from an AI system that hasn't been endowed?
So one example where emotion AI can be really helpful is conversational interfaces. Amazon Alexa today, for example, is very transactional, right? You ask her to do something, to play a song, order something, and she does it, and that's it. To move these conversational interfaces to become more effective, they have to have empathy. So for instance, if you ask Alexa to do something for you and she gets it wrong, and then you start getting more and more frustrated, well, a little bit of empathy goes a long way. She can say, I'm so sorry. It sounds like I didn't get this right. It sounds like you're upset. Like, how can I be helpful? So these kinds of empathetic reactions build more trust and translate into these devices becoming a lot more effective.
Right. And if we look at another example, how would an autonomous vehicle endowed with emotional intelligence look different from one that isn't?
We think of the application to automotive as being the eyes and ears of the cabin, especially when there isn't a driver. Again, imagine if with a number of optical sensors in the vehicle, we can detect how many people are in the car, what is their state, and use all of that information to personalize the cabin experience. You can, for example, if the occupants look like they're tired, the backseat passenger, for example, if he or she look tired, then maybe the cabin dims and, you know, you play a different type of music. So you can kind of start to reimagine what a mobility experience looks like. And we're kind of right in the midst of that.
I love that. It could make a car ride into an entirely different experience. What are some of the challenges of teaching this type of emotional intelligence to machines?
So a lot of this, like any machine learning problem, is very data hungry. So we spend a lot of our cycles thinking about how to get data that is diverse and representative of all of the different scenarios that we envision. So it has to be diverse from a gender and ethnicity perspective, different age ranges. For example, one use case is to detect if a child is left behind in a vehicle. Unfortunately, about 50 or so kids die in the car because they're just forgotten, right? And it's an easy problem to solve because if the car can detect that, it can, you know, send a text to the parent. So a child seat detector and a child detector is something that we are actively working on and the industry's really kind of pushing to add some of these safety functions in the vehicle. But we need a lot of data, right? We need data to support different car seats and different, you know, looking kids and different age ranges. I think data is a key component of this equation and it's key that it's diverse.
And how do you think about that data? What kind of vectors are you looking at as you program across the emotional intelligence spectrum?
So definitely like what kind of features are we looking for? So on the emotion side, we try to collect data that's not just face-based, but also voice-based. So the range of emotions we can elicit or look for is really key. And it's not just emotions, actually, cognitive states. Like we do a lot of driver monitoring work where we are looking for driver distraction or driver fatigue and drowsiness signals. So all of that factors into how we collect the data as well. And then again, diversity. We need to make sure we have a good representation of genders, geographies, people who wear glasses or have beards or wear the hijab. Like, the broader the data, the better this algorithm is going to be, because it'll have seen more and more examples of what's out there.
Great. And I know that some portion of the data is annotated by your team in Cairo and some is synthetic. Where do you collect your data from in general? Do you have a community of users out there?
We have a data collection facility just outside of Boston where, you know, we recruit people. They spend a few hours either driving one of our cars or, for instance, we have a drowsiness study where we have people spend, you know, an overnight in a car simulator. And so by the end of the night, they're really extremely tired, which is great because it's hard to collect real, you know, drowsiness data. Yeah, exactly. Well, fatigue is easier, but like extreme drowsiness obviously is very dangerous. So we can't elicit that in the real world. So we simulate it. But we also send people out with driver kits, essentially camera kits that they install in their vehicles. And we just collect the data over the course of a few months. And that data is super valuable because you see obviously spontaneous, naturalistic driving behavior, which is kind of both fascinating, but also super scary to see what people do on the road.
Yeah, you know, road rage. And there's so many emotions that driving elicits that it's an incredibly strategic move to start there for sure. How are you finding the reception towards the idea of emotional AI? Like, you spoke about just there's been enthusiastic reception for the use case of the child left behind in the car. Like, I'm curious how you're finding it, you know, in other aspects.
So it's evolved over time. 20 years ago, when I first started working in this area, it was really new and the use cases and applications of the technology weren't clear. When we spun Affectiva out of MIT, I remember when we were doing our first rounds of fundraising and doing our Sandhill Roadshow in the Bay Area, we avoided using the word emotion altogether. So if you look at our early pitch decks, we kind of danced around it. We used the word affect, hence the name Affectiva. We would talk about valence, which is how positive or negative your emotions are, but kind of really try to avoid using the word emotions. But fast forward to today, there's a lot more understanding that emotions play a really critical role in every aspect of our lives. And also there's a renewed interest in empathy, especially now, you know, we're recording this during the pandemic and we've all been catapulted into this universe where we interact virtually and meet virtually. And we need technology to incorporate all of the richness of our communication so that we can feel that it's a shared experience. We're not there yet, but I think we're going to see a lot more innovation that incorporates emotion AI into our video conferencing platforms.
No, for sure. I think, you know, with the grand challenge of trying to understand human communication, being able to incorporate an understanding of the emotions behind the words, it's critical. I did a podcast episode with Jerome Pacenti at Facebook, who was talking about multimodal communication through memes, for example, which is there's a disconnect between, you know, the visual and the text, and that's how you create irony. And in the same way, you know, people say does not always match the emotions that they're feeling, and being able to read that accurately was going to be incredibly powerful. One of the, I think, very compelling arguments that was made in favor of autonomous vehicles a few years ago was that human-driven vehicles is actually a design defect and that we should have always had vehicles that were smart, you know, on the road and being able to navigate traffic. And I'm curious if you have found any use cases where we could make a similar case that AI without emotional intelligence is a design defect.
I would kind of use the example around mental health and how we think about mental health and quantify mental health today. It is so subjective. Like, if you walk into a doctor's office, they don't ask you for your temperature or blood pressure. They just measure it. But in mental health, the gold standard is still, you know, a survey. And all of the apps we have today that try to kind of quantify mental health, it's all survey based, which is very subjective. It's not longitudinal data. So imagine now if incorporated into our technologies, into our phones, our cars, our social media platforms, et cetera, we are able to quantify a person's facial and vocal biomarkers that indicate level of stress, level of anxiety, depression, Parkinson's. And you can learn a person's baseline. And then if they deviate from it, you can flag that to the person, you can flag it to a confidant or a family member or even a doctor. It just allows us to be a lot more objective in how we think about mental health. So I'm really excited about the application of the technology in that space. And also think about how you then support a person if, say, they are depressed. If you can do this real-time quantification of their state, you can provide just-in-time empathetic feedback that can, you know, nudge them to take the right actions.
Get them the resources they need. Yeah, you potentially save lives here.
Yeah, I believe that, you know, at some point in the future, the default human-machine interface will be perceptual, will be conversational, will have empathy, and it will mirror how humans communicate with one another. I mean, a keyboard or, you know, even touch interfaces are not the natural way humans communicate. And so I'm excited when this will become ubiquitous. I really believe it'll be just integrated into our daily devices, everything from your car to your TV to maybe even your fridge, right? If it can detect that you're stressed and it locks down and doesn't let you eat that extra pint of ice cream.
Yeah, if you want that. I don't know if people would be willing to program it in.
Right.
Well, no, that's amazing. I think, you know, as you've been saying, that there's really an incredible opportunity here to do so much good with this technology. I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the dangers of emotional recognition. I think there's always the fear that our systems are going to know us, and maybe they already do know us better than we know ourselves, like impulse buying or, you know, clicking on clickbait on YouTube videos. There's some concern around privacy or Big Brother. How are you addressing this in the work that you're doing?
First of all, I do want to acknowledge that this can go terribly wrong. Like a lot of technology, there are amazing applications that can be truly transformative for society. But if we're not careful, this can be used to discriminate against people, manipulate people in all sorts of ways. So I've been very vocal about how this can also go wrong. And I believe that as AI innovators and thought leaders, we ought to be at the forefront of that, thinking through the unintended consequences. So as an example, we at Affectiva, from day one, really, have decided a number of core values that influence our business strategy. So for instance, we won't do any work where people aren't consenting or opting in explicitly. So that means that we don't do any work in surveillance or security or lie detection applications. We think very, very carefully about data bias, because if you accidentally build bias into these systems and then deploy them, you know, globally and at scale, then you have multiplied the bias that exists in our society and accentuated that. So that's another area where we try to be very intentional.
Yes, multiplying the bias is exactly the problem that we need to avoid. Can you talk to me more about how you're pushing on this bias question? It's a very complicated issue. It's very difficult to solve.
Thank you for saying that, because it is actually really complex. So at the core of it, to mitigate bias, you want to make sure that the data is diverse, and it's diverse across these many, many factors, which very quickly becomes really complex. But it's not just that, it's how you train. So how do you sample the data to train this algorithm? And you want to make sure that the data is balanced across all of these factors that you care about. And then when you validate the algorithm, so when you're testing, there's usually a test set that the algorithm has not seen before. When I was a PhD student, you know, 20 years ago, the way we tested these algorithms is we looked at one accuracy score. So if I wanted to see how accurate my smile classifier is, I would just like look at, you know, how it does on a data set. Well, that's not good enough right now, because you can very easily hide biases for certain populations if you just look at it, you know, as one holistic score. So we now break it down by subpopulation to really try to uncover where these biases may have been accidentally built into the system, which then means if you find something that looks off, you have to go back and retrain the algorithm. So it's a very iterative process. You need to be super intentional. I will also say you need the team around the table thinking about how to architect all of this to be diverse, because we each have our own blind spots and prior experiences that we bring to the table. And if we all have the same prior experiences and we all look the same and think the same, we're going to have a lot of blind spots.
Well, it's wonderful that you do have a diverse team. It seems like this space is so complicated, this unraveling of bias and unrooting it, that it almost feels like at some point we will want to call on experts who have thought a lot about this and built multiple systems of fairness. I had a conversation with Bernhard Trout from MIT on AI and ethics.
And he talked about leaving some of the judgment calls around what is fair to local communities, which is actually how our own government is structured. It's a federalist form of government. It's divided between federal, state, and local. So yes, it's a very, very complicated area.
And it's interesting to see, like, as different technologies compete in the marketplace, which ones are going to win out. And, you know, the ones that win out, if they haven't thought about bias as much, that would obviously be problematic for what's deployed. So something that we should constantly be thinking about as the technology evolves, as it gets out there, thinking about, like, which ones are winning this race.
I also think the role of investors becomes really important. You know, you've spent many, many years, you know, in the investment world. And if investors don't place value on companies that prioritize ethics and prioritize mitigating bias and all of these issues, then a company like Affectiva that really cares about this and really invests a lot of our bandwidth and time and money solving for these problems, then we're not necessarily getting rewarded, right? So I think the investment community needs to mirror these values and place value on them.
Yes, absolutely. I think if there's a way to quantify the value of unbiased data, and I think, you know, the most obvious answer is, like, this is going to be required in the future and it needs to be built right from the very beginning. So if someone is building a system that hasn't accounted for bias issues, it may actually not be usable.
Exactly. It's not just the right thing to do. It's like a business imperative. It just won't work if it's biased in any way.
Which leads to another question about something we talked about in our prior conversation. What was it like for you to raise money as a female founder?
The short answer is it was tough. Mm-hmm. So when we spun out of MIT, it was Roz and I who raised our initial rounds of funding. And actually, when I look back, when we did the Sand Hill Roadshow, we ended up meeting maybe 20-ish investors. We never met a female investor.
What year was that again? You said 2009?
Mm-hmm. 2009. I think the world has changed a little bit, but we have a lot of work to do. So I'm part of the All Raise community. I'm on the steering committee of the Boston chapter. And as you know, it supports both female founders, but also female partners and female investors. So I feel very strongly that we need to build the whole ecosystem and just have more women in these roles and highlight these women, because, you know, representation matters. And the more examples and role models you see, the more normal it becomes. So in my most recent round, so we raised $26 million about a couple of years ago, I was adamant to bring in funds that had more diversity or cared about diversity. And I'm proud to say that one of the funds we brought in has a female partner and two of the three have persons of color.
That's wonderful. What stage are you at now with your company? What are your goals for the next 5 years?
So we're heads down focused on bringing our technology to the automotive industry and really kind of realizing this vision of improving road safety and reimagining the future of mobility with this in-cabin sensing solution. So that's in the next 3 to 5 years, this technology will be in market. The automotive industry is notoriously slow. So that's kind of one area. And then just really exploring where else can this be applied. I know there's a lot of interest in multiple industries. So I'm excited to find a path to bring that to fruition.
I can imagine one of the challenges for you is that this would be in such high demand across so many industries, but being able to pick one and focus and having that be your test case, that must have been really difficult to narrow it down. Like, how did you pick automotive in particular?
I always tell people it's the most exciting thing about the space we're in, but it's also the most challenging thing. I mean, we do this routinely. We take a step back and evaluate, like, the different industries and verticals for product market fit, for market readiness, for technology readiness. And a few years ago, we identified automotive as an area that's ripe for disruption, where at the time with Mobileye and other players in the space, the focus was on what's happening on the outside of the vehicle. And we felt that the next trend was going to be about in-cabin sensing and turning the AI inward, if you like. So we decided to make an investment there. But you're absolutely right. Like, it comes up almost every other week where I'm like, but I know that there are applications in mental health, or what about video conferencing or retail? Like, we're always bombarded with inbound requests from all these other industries. So I haven't figured out how to
balance that.
In fact, Harvard Business School wrote a case study about us, essentially mapping out these two different business strategies. On the one hand, we could be a platform company that is industry agnostic, but, you know, is that viable or not? And then the other approach, which is the one we're on right now, where we're focused on a handful of industries and we're going very deep to solve a specific pain point.
Oh, that's fascinating. So they did a case study on you. Have you gotten feedback out of the case study? What do the students think?
Yeah, I was like, okay, give me the answer, you HBS kids, right?
Right.
I think there's just so much fascination around all of the different use cases, right? Any conversation I'm in, you know, once I explain the technology to people, they're like, but wait, have you thought about dating apps? Like, you should do a dating app, right? Or like a gaming, build a game that's emotionally intelligent.
I hear you. I'm constantly bombarded with inbound inquiries. They can take you in so many different directions. And I think that ability to really narrow down and focus on where your core strengths are is so critical to success. In previous episodes, I've actually spoken with Andrew Ng and Peter Abiel about the process of starting a company. And, you know, it's been great to hear some of your thoughts as well about what that was like for you. But I'd love to turn to the topic of writing a book, which we haven't actually talked about on this podcast, and what that process is like. So my own debut novel came out in January this year. And what I found is that it's actually just the beginning of a journey of getting ideas into the world. But I'd love to kind of talk about your process. Like, I think what people don't often realize is that the process of publishing a book can be really involved. It can take 12 to 18 to 24 months from the moment a publisher accepts the book to the day it comes out into the world. But even backing it further than that, the decision of like what type of book to write. So I'd love to hear like how you decided to approach Girl Decoded as a memoir. And I loved that you approached it that way, where it includes both like kind of your background and your own personal journey into your career, as well as your views on technology. And then, you know, it's like the last chapter that you start to go into this area of AI and intelligence. How did you decide to approach your book in this way as a memoir?
Initially, the idea was to write a book about emotion AI. And I remember I had lunch with one of the editors at Penguin Random House in New York. And he started the lunch meeting by saying, hey, I just want to let you know, I think the market is flooded with AI books. We're not taking on any more AI books. But, you know, I wanted to take the lunch meeting. So I was like, okay, well, that's going to be a waste of time. So he said, tell me your personal story. And I said, well, I grew up in the Middle East, you know, did my PhD in computer science, then came to MIT, became a CEO of this tech company. And I just like basically ran him through my life story. And he was like, mm-hmm. That's the book. The book has to be this juxtaposition of this Middle Eastern woman who ends up being, you know, an American CEO of a tech company. And so we ended up with this vision of, yeah, interweaving the two stories because they are super interweaved.
And you talk about this in the book, how your background and your personal life and your work are very much intertwined.
Totally. I also felt very strongly that as we started writing the book, I wanted to be really vulnerable. So I put myself out there and I share a lot of my experience going through a divorce and moving with my two kids without any family to the United States. I wanted to be very open, and I found because I was very open, it just started a lot of new friendships and a lot of honest conversations with people all over the world. It's, as you said, I feel like writing the book is the beginning. I don't know exactly the beginning of what, but it's the beginning of a new chapter of my life, and I'm excited about it.
Absolutely. I definitely see that there's so many growth opportunities that come from publishing a book. And, you know, for me, when the book hit the New York Times list and it was optioned for film, and the opportunity to just meet with a lot of leaders in so many industries, like people who resonated with the themes and the storylines. And what I think I found is that when you publish a book, people are able to find you, the ones that, you know, I think understand what it is that you're trying to do with your work. And so that's actually really exciting. That's, I think, where the community building aspect comes in.
Absolutely. It's very exciting.
Yeah, I'm very excited for like where you are now. What are some of the growth opportunities that you're seeing?
I think what I underestimated in writing the book and getting it out there in the world is the impact it has on people. So I routinely get emails or notes from random people who read the book and it resonated with them in one way or another, and they decided to take action, right? Whether it's a career decision that they decided to make based on something I said in the book about humanizing technology, or maybe they decided to take on AI ethics because now they feel like it's so critical to society. Or sometimes it's personal decisions, right? Like it might be a young person somewhere in Africa or India stumbled upon my book and now they're like, yes, I want to pursue my graduate education and I'm going to make it happen, right? So I underestimated, I guess, the power of my voice, and it's really causing me to do a lot of soul searching on what can I do with this superpower, right?
Yeah, the opportunity to connect with this many people. It's an incredible privilege.
Yeah, I don't want it to go to waste, right? I want to be able to use it for good. And I haven't figured out exactly what form that takes. If you have ideas, let me know.
Right. No, I think we'll probably figure it out together. You know, one of the questions I frequently got on my book tour was why fiction? And I think it's similar with you, with your story, with your memoir. One thing that I found really resonated, especially with technical audiences, was the concept that reading fiction is a great way to build emotional intelligence, which ties back into the theme of the podcast episode. You know, and for me, writing also built empathy. So like engineers would come up to me and they would say, you know, do you have fiction books to recommend? Because I need to build my emotional intelligence. And so I actually find that fascinating. You know, maybe this is some of the turn that you're seeing as well. Like there was a recent HBR piece, but it's just one of many I've seen over the past few years about how reading about other characters and putting yourselves in the lives of other people and getting inside them is a great way to build empathy.
Absolutely. Yeah. We definitely need more empathy in the world. So that's great.
Yeah. Well, Rana, this has been so much fun. I want to, from here, just like open up to see if there's anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners that we maybe didn't get a chance to touch on.
I mean, I guess my final thought is that even though I, you know, spent the last 20 years in the business of artificial intelligence and building AI, at the core of it, it's about humans first, right? And building this human connection that may or may not be mediated by technology. So I try to stay true to that. It's all about the human connection.
Absolutely. Rana, are you planning on writing another book? Is that in the near future for you?
You know, I have a backlog of book ideas now, which I, when I was writing the book and people would say, oh, maybe you'll write another book. I was like, no way. But now I think I have another book in me, maybe. Are you writing another book?
I just turned in a draft of my second novel to HarperCollins.
Love it. Amazing.
Thank you.
That's awesome.
I'm thrilled that we had a chance to connect and to hear about your work. I'm looking forward to following your very exciting journey over the next years.
Thank you for having me. And I'm also excited to be connected now.